Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, Kurt. Let's hear that Bobby. That's fun.
All right, here we go.
Neufeld makes such sweet sounds. He's got a great sense of, you know, sugar, sweet tooth.
Yeah, he does. He's got a nice bass. I like the bass.
Yeah.
The bass seems to resonate with my generation. I don't know. We like bass.
Well, I remember in 1968, Life magazine, maybe June 28th. I'm pretty good with visual details. Zappa wrote an article called, or they titled it, "The Oracle Has It All Psyched Out." And it's very interesting because at that time they were calling McLuhan the Oracle of the Electric Age. And I always wonder if Zappa or Life magazine was referring to McLuhan. Who knows? But Zappa himself was considered an oracle of advice for the older parents trying to understand what was going on with the kids that fostered you, your parents,
yes,
so to speak. And in it, he talked about – he used the term bone conduction. He said the kids love this music. It gets them right in their bone. And I guess if we, that would be the beginning of proprioceptive or tactile response to music, not a visual following the road of melody or just limited to sound. It was bone conduction. And as your generation goes deeper, grew up deeper immersed in the tactile world, then if we call bass as approximate to bone conduction, then that would explain why your generation goes more into bass. It's scraping and sculpting and massaging your bone, like Zappa talked about.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. It's scraping the bone.
I always
that should be the
we gotta call our show that. Scraping the bone. Scraping, you know, what is it? Episode 3001, subtitled Scraping the Bone.
Scraping the Bone.
But you always find what I say makes total sense for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. It must be there must be something wrong with me, but yeah.
No, there's something correct about you, Kurt. You're just lucky. You kept your intuitive awareness.
Well, thank you, Bob.
So, Kurt,
I
why don't we? Even, very
well,
good.
I was gonna ask, did you ever get?
Let
that,
me say. Let me say this,
okay.
Kurt. Instead of talking about me, remember, let's get into Lost as soon as possible. But go ahead with what you're going to say.
There's Lost, yeah, and then I also sent you a information about Brittany Murphy. Did you get that?
Yes, but I haven't had a chance to look at it. Did we didn't go into that, or we did? No, we discussed that last show. We did that in depth.
No, we didn't. You're gonna ask. Ion about her.
Okay, I forgot to do that.
That's okay.
Yeah, so let's do that next week.
I want to keep that warm for you. I want to keep that.
Yeah, good. And you can even just send an email and remind me to do it.
Okay.
I'll be talking to Ion this week. We could even do it. No, I'll do it privately. We get more information privately than if I did it on cash flow. There we have to consider the audience and the Pope and the CIA listening. You know, we have to, or Ion considers that. So you don't always get everything on cash flow.
I understand.
If you have a private reading, you get everything. I did my homework.
Last week you told me to listen to the cash flow show concerning Lost. So I actually did follow through on that.
Okay. I have not I like to watch every episode twice, and I have not seen the finale twice, so it's not fresh in my mind. But what I would say about what Ion said, what I remember, is that he was emphasizing Eloise and the Overtons. It was obscure, and I was wondering what you thought of that.
I just have a hard time following it. I was looking for a kind of more broader kind of media media ecology, Android meme kind of definition of what was going on with the last episode.
Well, Ion knows that I do that, and Ion tries to provide the other view, the non-Bob view. Like, if I say something, Ion will go, however, and then Ion will go into his astral plane view.
Right.
So what do you remember, even though it was...
Go on.
No, I can do the Android meme part, but let's go into what you got from what Ion said, even though it was specialist. Or,
I mean, it was out there, man. It was out there. I mean, he was focusing more on the Whitmore and his wife and the son, Faraday, and the party.
Right.
Whereas I'm more obsessed about what the hell just happened. Period.
Okay, let's go into. We'll drop Ion right now. It might come back relevant as we get into what you say about it. So you start talking about it. What you like or didn't like, or what you get from it, where the questions are. Just start thinking out loud, and then I can respond.
Oh well, I liked it. I enjoyed it. I was left a little lost, and the one thing I regret was that they didn't go more into Libby. Because she was probably my favorite character on there.
Yeah.
And I was kind of hoping we'd figure out what the hell was the deal with Libby.
Yeah, because she kind of knew something ahead of time. Or, you know, she knew... She was aware of parallel worlding or something. She understood...
Right, and Hurley did, too. You know, because he kind of... He could see the dead people. And he even before that, you know, he was like, I guess you could say he was like a schizophrenic or something, because he was always hallucinating that guy that followed him to the island, even.
Right.
That weird guy. So, you know, I liked it, but I was kind of left, like, wanting more, I suppose.
Okay, so you got Hurley, who can see dead people. And you've got Libby, who is somehow aware of having done this before or something, or knowing ahead of time what was going on. That is the ionic level. That is seeing dead people. That's talking to Ion. So you see, Ion's perspective is very important, because it's about the psychic world, what we call the psychic world. And, you know, and I told you that J.J. Abrams is very interested in that world, and he presents the psychic world very intelligently. Like, remember in the early part of Lost where Claire goes to that Australian psychic guy?
Right,
and he sees the plane crash or something, you know, and he doesn't want to talk about it. And then later, when his wife and daughter are freaked out over something, they come back to him, and he denies anything about psychic stuff. Abrams is showing this is an intelligent psychic. He's media ecological. He knows not to get involved with the android meme, and he's not into just promoting himself. He knows when to say what in the right situation. That's a very good presentation of an intelligent psychic person, because they're usually presented
and
very
like
one. I was just going to say, they usually, you know, all through the history of Hollywood, psychics are presented as very one-dimensional, exaggerated situations. You know, it's stupid. Okay, go ahead, what you're going to say.
Oh, yeah, sorry. You know, and then there was even that episode where they went to him and he was like a total, like, hack, basically.
Yeah,
remember?
Yes, and, I think he did it, if I remember, he did it on purpose. He wanted not to be known to be a psychic.
Right, right.
That's what
kind
I mean.
Like
he was being he was being ecological. He understood what the people or audience or police or whatever would say. He was smart about it.
Okay.
And I've never seen Hollywood ever present a psychic being smart like that.
No, it's usually they have the little old lady, or they have like you know, like in Poltergeist.
Yeah, yeah. Not an adult who does readings and does good readings and is not on a megalomaniac trip, knows how to appear, doesn't mind appearing stupid occasionally.
Yes. Which,
no, that's never been done before as far as I know. I mean, Abrams knows. He understands a lot of the world I'm in.
And that's why, I mean, you know, I kind of tailor make my talk show host as being the guy who appears stupid, or at least he's not afraid to appear stupid.
Right. No, and since it's such a fragmented audience and multi-consciousness world, you don't know where anybody is at, so what is stupid to one person is very intelligent to another. So you can't fail when you understand this, when you're providing content on a medium. You can't fail.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, you got something there. You really can't.
Yeah. It's just whatever the people are, for whatever reason, you can't force them to listen to you. But if they listen to you, there's a range of responses. Right in even in the people who like the show, some of them are going to get upset when it goes directions like we're doing today. They don't like Lost. Oh, they're tuned out because they don't want to hear about Lost. And I'm not going to listen to Kurt this week. But then someone else may not even know about Lost and get intrigued by what we say. You can't. There's no audience. I said to Carol when she first went on TV back in 86, I said, there's no audience, Carol. You're talking to nobody. So, you know, have fun with it. And that's another way of saying it doesn't matter what the audience thinks. And then maybe that's what's limited about Howard Stern. He plays off a certain image of what the audience is interested in. My radio shows, you never know where we're going, and we really hype it up with Ion. You just can't believe it. I did an incredible celebration, my 40th anniversary, which I'll send to you. I'll make a sound excerpt of it at the beginning of Castle last week. It's the first time a human being's ever said what I said about their marriage, and I had the opportunity to do it to an ostensible audience. Who is that audience? I don't know, and I don't care, but there are people listening to it and write emails and go, wow, that was awesome.
See, well, I admit you often say things that no human being has ever said before.
Yeah, and I first heard that phrase from Garrett Dean. He used to say stuff. He was just a great talker, and I'd be listening to him when I first met him. And he'd say something, and I I didn't know that it had never been said before. He would just say, and Bob, that's never been said before. He was the first guy I ever heard say that. And so I adopted that. So I specialize in saying what's never been said before.
So
see, we're already off and running. We're off and laughing already.
Yeah, we are. We're going. We're always going. We go right away. What are you up to today? It's noon there, right?
Yes, it's noon. I am just finishing up season 6 of 24.
Really?
Yeah, this is maybe the best TV show I've ever seen. It's an incredible. It's a Menahan satire, even. I don't know if the authors, the writers, Cochran, one of them's named Cochran, and Joel somebody. I wrote them down. They were the creative producers. I started watching 24 this year, the final season. I'd heard about it. I mentioned this last week. I heard Rush Limbaugh interview the writers or the creators or something.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, he was very impressed with the show, and I heard him talk about it. I just happened to catch the show that day. I didn't watch TV, you know, for many decades. I had a TV. Carol might watch a show or two, but I didn't do it. And the last time I watched TV was in the 80s when I would watch the week's news summary, because I'd go on Mike Dyer every 2 weeks, so I had to find out what was going on in the Android meme. And so I did just watch this news summary and get the general themes that were happening that week. And that was during the time of the wall going down and all that, you know, 89, 90.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
So that was my last time I watched TV. I did it for the show, just to be aware of what the Android meme was saying. And then I could just take anything that was said and then come up with something on it. I'm instant pattern recognizer. That's my ability. Okay, so never watched anything. I saw the X-Files movie once, you know. So I didn't see anything and didn't need to. And I knew it was all the afterimage of the Android meme, especially by 2000. So when I heard a bit about 24, when I heard it on Rush Limbaugh, I said, oh, this is the real Iraq war. This is the TV landscape doing the war that 911 was supposed to create. Since it was so, they couldn't do it with chemical bodies, didn't have any money, they couldn't even give uniforms to the soldiers, and Blackwater and those guys are running around doing their private war. There was no chemical body war related to the effect of 911, but 24 was the real war. That was an image I had of it back when I first heard about it in 2003 or 4. So I never watched it. But this past year, I got into Lost and Fringe and Flash Forward and Warehouse 13 and Eureka, just all these things that Ion was pointing out, that a lot of the themes that Ion was talking about were just surfacing in the TV landscape, you know, all over the place. So I started watching it, and I don't know why I decided to look at 24. And I think I saw every show as they happened during this past year. And that was really enjoyable. I thought it was interesting how it showed Quadrophenia. It always showed four institutional figures, you know, the tensions in their own worlds in relation to the other four. You know, you've seen it, the four screens they would always show as they showed the time.
Yeah, I've only seen that show like once. So it is where you think it's worth watching.
Okay, so well, I don't know if it's worth watching, but here's – so I watched it this year, and I thought, wow, this is very adrenaline-rushing. You know, really, they use their MK Ultra knowledge to just zap up everybody. It's endless pressure, never stops every episode. But what was great, and I don't remember how I started this season 8, which I knew it was the final season, so I said, okay, I'll watch this. And I guess I watched it, caught up on it, and then had to wait for each week as we got into this year, 2010, until we got to the finale. So now that Fringe and Lost is over for the summer, I thought I'd go back and look at season 1 of 24. This must be 3 or 4 weeks ago, and see how it started. You know, I was interested in what had happened in season 8. So I started watching season 1, and that was interesting. And then I went to Netflix. If you go into Hulu, you got to put up with commercials. If you go to Netflix, they got it right there, all of it. And there's no commercials. So you go from one break to the next, it can go on forever. So on season 1 or 2,
Yeah,
maybe,
like that's how I watched Lost. I have an Xbox, and I'd stream it to my Xbox so I could watch it on TV through my Xbox.
With no commercials, right? So it's
no,
perfect.
No commercials, yeah.
And so I started watching first season one night, and I stayed up for 24 hours and pretty well went through the whole season, and it was such a great movie experience. See, I remember Dylan saying in the 70s that he liked Asian Indian movies. They'd go for 7 hours, and he wanted Hollywood to do more longer movies. And, if you like a movie, just continue it, you know, keep going. So my experience of doing 48-hour period, you know, I had to do some other things in between, had a couple of readings, clients for Ion and this and that. But the watching it, it was so exciting to go from one episode to the next and not have to wait a week and go right into it. And then you can get into the drama knowing that you can keep continuing with it. So I went straight through. I've never done that, watched that much, that long of a media experience. You know, I'd never gone for 24 or more hours to see 24 hours. I thought that was great. That was really good. So I said, okay, I'll wait a week and then do another 24-hour stretch. But then I found I couldn't wait, so I started nibbling at season two. So I've nibbled, and I've gone up to 14-hour stretches over the past 2 weeks. I'm just finishing season six today, and I'm just doing episode 22 right now. And then I just got season seven left, and I'll probably go through that leisurely because after that it's all over. There's no more. So I've got the gist of it, and as it unfolded, it's an incredible Dobbstown view. It's about the guy Jack Bauer is doing what I claimed I did. He saves everybody. He's always saving everybody, and it's a cartoon. There's not a ridiculous, dangerous situation he can't get out of. I mean, it's total fantasy, right? It's totally ridiculous.
So do you feel like it kind of reflects like what you were up to when you were part of the international community of?
Exactly.
You can't
Secret
say
Council
which
organization. 10. Secret Council 10. Solar
is
government.
Secret Council 10, is that the same? Is that the ones that you were working for when you were doing those assassinations and all that?
Yeah. Secret Council 10,
oh, okay.
And I called it the Solar Government because it was telecommunications. It was a chip landscape before people really had it in their normal life, and it was beyond world government. Everybody's in the same room, and so if you look at 24, it takes place in the counterterrorism CTU, counterterrorism unit, and its central node, its secret, it's a division below the Secret Council 10. Secret Council 10 doesn't get all panicky, you know. They recognize that management will run around and do everything and create confusions, and that's good enough. That's propaganda. And so Secret Council 10 is, the CTU, counterterrorism unit, is the people who worked for me and the secret, they were a level below the Secret Council 10. They're between the world government and the solar government. And so Jack is really the solar government guy because he's running around solving all the problems while the bureaucrats in the White House, in the FBI, Department of Justice, other bureaucracies, local police, are all stumbling, you know, Keystone Cop stuff, all frustrating. Jack has to shoot occasionally has to kill a bureaucrat to solve the problem, you know. And it's really an interaction of the chemical body landscape, the astral landscape, not so much the astral, but you can find that in there, and the TV landscape and the chip landscape. So the TV landscape is the White House. Everything's focused around the White House there. All the presidents, David Palmer, his brother Wayne becomes president, and then there's Charles Logan in there. They're all just trying to figure out how to make the role of the White House acceptable to the public. So they justify all their cover-ups because you can't violate the people's security, sense of security, right? So
right.
So you've got that image in that old landscape of the TV, what I call a TV landscape, which we personalize through the digital landscape into a TV body. Then you have the counterterrorism unit, which is the chip landscape. They could not function without all their amazing digital surveillance equipment and cell phones. Most of the show is people talking, phoning each other. That's all it is, no acting. You just phone somebody and say, we're doing this, doing that. Then you get blown up, and then someone has to phone someone else and say, okay, you do this, and then you do that. It's all on the cell phone and holding your arms forward in that pistol posture. You know, you walk along with the gun sticking out, waiting to shoot somebody around the corner. So, so that's the chemical body language. Just point the gun, keep pointing and moving, and while on the cell phone. That is the essence of the drama. And so the chip landscape is represented by CTU, and they are dealing with the autonomous effects of terrorism cells and other factions in the bureaucracies doing their own trips. They're trying to monitor all that. There's total chaos going on the chip landscape, always, 24/7. And the president, it's so much what McLuhan said in Take Today in 1972. The president is an automated presidential – no, he said the superlative nobody is the automated presidential surrogate. You see, the president now is not the president. The president is the guy who runs the CTU unit, the one who's dealing with the daily crises as autonomous cells all over the world explode here and there, trying to take over something, you know?
I see.
So you got the chip landscape dealing with the panic, and then you've got TV, the president trying to pretend there is no panic, can't panic the people. It shows the merger. The TV landscape can't keep up with the chaos that's going on in the chip landscape. So it's so stupid to be president. All you do is sit there and wait for the latest cell phone message about what wasn't solved and how Jack killed somebody but solved another issue. you could make a great independent movie, just string together all the times that Jack hits somebody or shoots somebody, you know, through the 8 seasons. It would go on for like 3 hours. It's just a guy hitting, knocking their legs out, hitting someone in the head, you know, getting out of it. He's impossibly imprisoned, and he gets out anyways. Okay, so there's two ways to look at it. There's the collective effect of the TV landscape, and then the individual exploitation of it. And in the chip landscape, you got the collective use of it. That's the CTU. And then the private individual who's floating around the whole landscape, all of the landscapes and bodies, the private individual hijacking it. So you have Jack is the hijacker of the chip landscape. He doesn't follow any rules, and everybody has to deal with the fallout of what he does. And then you have the president hijacking the TV landscape. So Charles Logan and Jack are mirror images of each other. And Jack thinks he's doing it for the TV landscape. He must save the country. So he's hyper chip body working for the TV landscapes propping up, but he has to deal with the actual situation of the TV landscape is nothing but corruption and hijacked by people like President Logan. You know, like, he's working for nobody. And he finally admits in this season he's hijacked and taken to China for 18 months and tortured, and he comes back. And he gets out of that impossible situation, and then he's sitting there, and he can't do it anymore. It's just, it's all so meaningless. He's actually getting to the level that me and my father discussed in my diaries, you know, back in 64, the 60s, the meaninglessness of any chemical body trying to interact with all these landscapes. And here's the main theme. It's always a new bureaucrat. The new CTO director comes in because the other one screwed up because of what Jack did. So everybody has to resign. And they come in all pompous and order everybody around and reform the thing. And within a half a show or a show later, they're gone. It's a satire on these pompous bureaucrats who run the show for about 15 minutes. So, you know, updating of Andy Warhol, everybody will have an executive position for 15 minutes.
So is that what's happening with Obama? Is that why, like, he was on for about 15 minutes and then and nobody really cared anymore after a while?
That's right. Because you see, Jack represents everybody. Everybody's running around, as Ion says. We don't need laws, anybody. Nobody's following them anyways, no matter what level.
It's true.
Yeah. Nobody really follows the law. And the present, nobody can, because that's all visual literate space, and it cannot deal with the proprioceptive, tactile, post-Android meme, post-information reality we're in, with the mystery landscape showing up. So you have Jack. He's described I'm very impressed with the way it presents is exactly what I was talking about in the 80s. I was always talking about the different media landscapes conflicting with each other and the different bureaucracies creating this absurd situation where I could be like Jack Bauer and tell the truth, bring in the evergreens, tell everybody who killed who and how I did this and that, and nobody could stop me because it was too much chaos because everybody else was trapped in their various media jobs or bureaucratic jobs or whatever stupid jobs they had. They couldn't stop Bob going forward.
Right, and then and also just, no one believed you anyway.
Right, and so I'm saying that I think 24 is, if you look at the way I'm looking at it, is a great classroom, a great text, like people used to study The Prisoner back in university in the 70s and 80s, that 1970s Patrick McGoohan show, The Prisoner. You ever seen that?
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was taught in school.
Number six.
They should take this thing that I'm saying today and teach it in class, in school, immediately, if they even want to go to school. I mean, but you don't even need to go. Just everybody should hear this, how 20 years later, it's so obsolete, the quadrophenic institutional battle within the Android meme, that it becomes a major TV show showing what Bob talked about 20 years ago. And I see the writers, they are. It's all presented, serious panic. I mean, there's nuclear bombs going off, terrible disasters. But the overriding point, I think, that the writers are making is showing how absurd it all is. And the absurdity, seeing that absurdity this late, is no great genius. Most people are in the whatever, you know. It's just too much for everybody. They can see it through other earlier TV shows or just their own experience. There's no order going on. And most of the institutions and landscapes are worried that there's no order. Ion's the only one who's saying, me and Ion and Carolyn are saying, hey, this disorder is great. This is perfect. Just get over your old rules about it.
Right, yeah, I like it,
And so it's a satire of Jack Bauer. I don't know what's, I know what happens in the end of season 8. I don't know how it ends in season 6 or season 7, but knowing season 8, he never understands this. Jack Bauer is a total fool. And it was interesting, on one of the cash flows or somewhere, I asked Ion to go through the characters. It might have been on Tailgate. And he said the coolest person in the last season of 24, which takes place in New York, whereas all the previous seasons, at least up to season 6, take place in L.A. Don't know where season 7 takes place. And I don't like to read up on it beforehand. I just want to be surprised. But it takes place in New York in last season. And he says, Ion says, he, she, it, whatever Ion is, that Chloe, and you probably haven't seen enough, Chloe is the smooth tetra manager. She's the one who's the coolest and understands how to relax and allow and get things done. And Jack is dependent on her. Jack is the most unaware guy in the whole thing. That's how Ion saw it, and I agree with it. He said that weeks ago, and now that I've seen, almost 6 seasons, I agree with Ion. It has to be a satire, because the others are all zombies. Jack has the potential to be a knowing person, but he doesn't get it. He just, as one of his girlfriend's father's a senator, he says, Jack, you stay away from my family. Whoever you touch, there is death. He's a virus. Whoever he gets involved with ends up totally tortured and dead and great pain. He is a agent. He's the chaos butterfly.
He's the butterfly effect.
Yeah, he saves everybody all the time. Now look at this. This is a really great anti-hero, superhero stuff. It's a great, most modern thing. It's the Android meme making it better than what people did when they made Superman and all that. Android meme saying this is the way it is, because he doesn't get it. I missed the thread. Something about the satire of it all. I lost the thread. It'll come back. So you
It'll
talk for
back.
A minute.
I have a question about another Jack, though. And that would be Jack Shepard, who also trying to decide who represented the everyman on Lost. And it was
Jack Shepard. No, it's very, very good. Jack Shepard is the Jack Bauer of Lost, at least at the beginning.
That's what I thought.
And it could have since Lost started in 2004, I think. they could have been, Abrams may have been satirizing 24, because 24 had been going since November 2001. So, yeah, I'll take that as a commentary on 24, because Lost is like 24, but on an island. It's on a chemical body island, which has astral aspects of different dimensions or playing with time or parallel worlding, whereas the 24 is just about the chemical body running around panicked and useless in relation to the TV landscape and the chip landscape. I don't know what would be the astral, but you haven't seen enough of Lost, but they definitely don't have any psychic stuff like Lost.
No, I've seen all of Lost.
I meant 24. I'm saying I don't think there's any representation of the psychic astral world in 24. Don't think there is. So it's main. Now here's the thing. I've been saying for 20 years that the shrinking chip landscape and the shrinking of its bodies for yourself give you incredible autonomy. Incredible. You don't have to follow the rules in many ways. And that's what Jack is. He represents every man running around free of all the rules and on his own personal agenda, whatever he's concerned about, he tries to solve it. And he's presented as very successful. But in the end, maybe this is what I was going to say, it's so, what is it? He doesn't recognize. Oh, yeah, here, I got it. He works, he saves the world. He's in an hour-long episode. He saves something. Pretty well every show he saves something. But it's 24 of those shows over a season. So he saves the world 24 times, and he always gets arrested for doing it. No one ever has time to fucking sit down, give him some reward, or say he's really great. You only get David Palmer in the presence every now and then. Saying, this is great, Jack. You're great. And then there's another crisis that doesn't last long. Then Jack has to solve another problem. And the joke is he's always beat up for doing it, and he keeps trying to save the world.
That kind of harkens back to the old like Starsky and Hutch model, where they were kind of like the loose cannon, but the boss would always have to chew them out. But then he was always kind of glad that they were doing what they were doing.
It's that
total. The bureaucrat has to reprimand, but without him, they would be totally fucking lost.
That's right. He needs them, and they need him. And it's the yin yang totally turned into a knot. And the android meme is replaying that complementarity right back to everybody. And you can't get any slack out of that situation. So that's Starsky and Hutch. I never saw it. I remember that's a 70s series, I think. And if they were showing the autonomous, that was what was going on in the 60s. The 60s allowed post-television, post-computer, beginning of the post-satellite, the beginning of digital, more on the corporate level, the secret level, but the beginning of it where we had autonomy. We weren't controlled by cultures or technologies anymore. And I guess Starsky and Hutch started to show that. The actual cops, they couldn't be lawful citizens, even though they were preserving the law, because they were dealing with too many autonomous criminals who could do whatever they wanted to, I assume.
Right, and their hands were always tied, but they always just kind of said, screw it, we're going to do what we're going to do. We'll take the browbeating from the captain, because ultimately we know that it doesn't really mean anything. Because all the captain's ever going to say is, God damn it, you better not do this again.
Yeah, because...
And that's how it ended every week, was God damn it, you better not. You better stream up these shoes, They would never listen.
That's right. The bureaucrat would represent the impersonal technological environment. The chemical body of the bureaucrat, he couldn't do anything. He just had to sit there. Like, that's all the president does in 24. He just sits there and waits for the latest cell phone call from some faction. And this is the other part. Every faction, I say the android meme is made up of the Bolsheviks, the Jesuits, the Freemasons, the Nazis, and the Mossad. All right?
The Jesuits?
Oh, yeah. I've done this many times. Maybe you never heard it. The
Jesuits have power? I didn't think the Jesuits had any power.
Okay, here's the way it works. Before the printing press, there was manuscript culture, and in the West, the Catholic Church ran that. Okay?
Right.
They had their easy intelligence network. They worked with whatever Roman emperor was around. You know, whatever empire they would be the ideological icon for it. So they had no real competition until the printing press came in. And when the printing press came in, that was the British intelligence. That was the Francis Bacon and the Rosicrucians and the Royal Society of Science, whatever it's called, the Newton World, Isaac Newton. That intelligence network, as the British started to consolidate the oligarchic monies and trust funds, and a good historian on that is Lynn LaRouche. And so they start moving into the Atlantic Ocean, and the Mediterranean manuscript culture that was run by the Catholic Church is left behind. And so they play catch-up. So the Protestant Reformation comes in with Henry VIII, and that creates a whole new power structure, and we'll call that the Freemasons. So the Catholic Church, they have their historical nest egg of power, so they got to adapt to it. So they create, through Ignatius Loyola, they create the Jesuits, right? The Jesuits were the intelligence agency to fight the Freemason Protestant religion. Okay, so that goes on for a couple of
years. I never realized that.
Yeah, the printing press creates the Freemasons as an intelligent network locked into national currencies and economies, which the printing press created. And the Catholic Church is behind the eight ball on that, so they wait. They don't get going with the Jesuits till about 100 years later after the printing press, like 1560 or something, 1550. So they play catch up, and so you have the Continental Religious Wars for a couple hundred years, and then the newspaper comes in. And the newspaper, combined with the telegraph in 1850, creates the global village, where everybody is in the same environment. You pretty well have access to everywhere around the world if you're super wealthy like the Rothschilds and other not-so-known families like the Turner Taxes. Well, because the telegraph unites everybody as a new acoustic tactile space going around the visual space of the book and the manuscript, that creates the emotion of multitude, and that gives the rise of Marx and Engels, and the workers around the world feel that they can organize a proletarian power base because they're riding on the effect of the telegraph. Well, the intelligence agency that comes out of that is the Bolsheviks. They're the ones who take that emotional multitude caused by the telegraph and lock it down in Moscow. It had nothing to do with Marx per se. That was just like the Catholic Church used St. Peter and Jesus as a front. The Russians used the Bolsheviks used Marx and Engels, I guess. So and then later Lenin. Okay, so you have the Bolshevik power is now competing against the Jesuits and the Freemasons. And then radio comes in, and who consolidates power around radio? The Nazis.
That's
okay.
Right. Yeah, the Nazis. Yeah, they really like they latched onto that.
Yeah, and they create a temporary 15-minute world empire, and they have a nest egg. They get huge, bank accounts and gold and all this stuff, and so they can work with that after they fall. Just like the Jesuits always had wealth. If the Freemasons were dominating for a couple hundred years, the Jesuits had a backlog of wealth, and then the Freemasons had a lot of wealth when the Bolsheviks came in, and the Bolsheviks got a lot of wealth, and then the Nazis were the last guys. And then you have World War II, and it ended with the atomic bomb, which is the end of literate history. The end of history, McLuhan said, is 1945, August 6, 1945. So now
that's a quote from your album, actually.
Yes, yeah. We never left 1945.
Do you believe that? Or is that figurative?
No, that's what McLuhan said, and that is true, but then you have to understand what's been layered over it, overlaid on that fact. That's for world government. World government ends in 1945. World government had been there since the British Empire in the 19th century, and you had all these... he had these upstarts like the Bolsheviks and the Nazis trying to take over the world, the economic private trust funds and real wealth that was built up by the Jesuits, the Freemasons. Okay,
but it was
the Catholic.
But it was kind of too late by then.
What's too late? Oh yeah, that's a good point. I mean, radio wipes out the private ownership of money and brings in the welfare state, disguised as fascism, communism, socialism, democracy, the New Deal. These were all recognizing that money became public property and everybody had access to that ticket. They had to have it because the real wealth was coming out of the information environment. Now, I've done thousands of hours on this. I'm not going to repeat this pattern. I've probably done it with you occasionally. I just want to get into quickly what happens after 1945. You have the beginning of the virtual, what Croker, Arthur Croker calls virtual reality, and he's written on the virtual, not he, the word virtual reality is around independent of him, but he created this new update of Karl Marx, the theory of the virtual class. And that's what starts getting built by 1960, and that's what my chart's talking about, the 1960-1990 period, where you have the Catholic, the Jesuits and the Freemasons and the Bolsheviks and the Nazis and the Mossad, because Israel is built in the 50s, and because it's the early TV effect and there's this group consciousness that comes in with black and white TV, Israel had this great image because it was a social organization around the kibbutz, where it was like a commune. And that was actually how people live under TV conditions. So that Israel was a very charismatic image resonating with the effect of television, and the Mossad took advantage of that. So the Mossad becomes the interval between the Bolsheviks, the Nazis, the Freemasons, and the Jesuits, okay? And so you have these five intelligence groups trying to control the TV landscape. But it's a post-information society. No icon lasts long, and there's too much going on in the population and their creativity with electronic media and pop culture and all that, so that the intelligence agencies are sidelined. They only control the meme that there's money and you need to work for it. That's all they control. And the population in the 60s didn't know that money was not private property. The intelligence agencies prop up the idea that money's private property. Everybody, you can't bankrupt the economy, as everybody has seen the last 2 years. You know, you can't stop the typing because everybody's independent, and it doesn't matter who's the richest man in the world. They're just a pawn of the whole global, here comes everybody, typing complex of wealth generation. Okay, so that's what we mean by post-information. No information can stop anything. No particular press conference or cure. Okay, so we call that endless self-generation by everybody in the media environments they work in. And media means any technology. Like a guy who just works with bulldozers, that's his medium. So this self-generation of the android being working for itself, McLuhan said in Take Today in 1972, the super audience, like the super enterprise, works for itself. There's no, you just keep the medium going. You just keep typing or talking. So this is the android meme phase with the five factions pretending that information is significant. But they can't, by late 70s, early 80s, they can't, the population begins to notice that there's nothing stopping here. Why don't they expose JFK? I mean, the Senate Select Committee in 1979 on June 4th announced that there was mafia involvement in who killed Kennedy. Why does anybody do anything about it? Why did Walter Cronkite tell us, you know, stop the presses? It doesn't matter. You know, any news story doesn't. And this is what McLuhan meant when he said only puny secrets need protection. The, you know, actual hiding and protecting and classification by the intelligence agencies, national or global, only the puny ones, which means the non-secrets, the big secrets or the big discoveries are protected by public incredulity. And I am the testimony of putting out all this stuff for 25 years and nobody believes it because it's too incredulous, right?
Well, it's that, and I don't think, I mean, it's kind of like, it's anticlimactic. I mean, it's like when they, remember when, like, for how many years was, like, Deep Throat, like, Deep Throat's identity was, like, who's Deep Throat, Deep Throat? And then finally the guy comes forward, and nobody gives a fuck.
That's right.
How long did it last that anybody cared about Deep Throat? And nobody even remembers that that dude came forth. I didn't think it until you just mentioned it.
That's right, and nobody cares about what a quark or a quasar is, or an ion is, or a subatomic particle.
To be honest, I can't even remember what the guy's name is who came forth being Deep Throat.
Yeah, Mark somebody. Somebody.
Yes.
And he wasn't even the real Deep Throat. The real Deep Throat was Al Haig.
Ah.
I mean, I was involved with that. I was involved with that. I knew. I was part of that. And I used to say on the radio 25 years ago, it's Al Haig. And then when this Mark guy came out, I said, well, that's complex post-information android meme complexity. So that's just the faction that was temporarily got their 50 minutes of power need to have their Deep Throat, you know, so they can control it.
Yeah, but nobody cared.
Nobody's cared basically since they got Netscape in 1995, 94, 95, when Netscape came in and you started making your own computer, the rest of it didn't matter. All you did was pay attention to the mainstream old analog Android meme phase and make fun of it. See, so nobody cares, and it's not a problem that nobody cares. It doesn't matter. The world's going to continue turning over self-generating fake virtual information, whether you like it or not, or whether you show up and participate or not. If that's what we mean when the Android meme takes on a life of its own. Okay, now that's collapsed.
The oil's going to keep leaking no matter what.
That's right, and that's the collapse now. This is the great breakthrough the last couple of years that ION represents, but then we'll get to that. I'm explaining what happened with the five intelligence agencies, how they pretended they would create terrorism just to pretend they had a use. And that's what's symbolized by 24. Jack creates half the problems. And then what you find out in
it is a kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah, his overreactions and his, you know. Let me say this, though, Kurt.
Kurt, listen, this is an important punchline. This is what you learn in season 6. That who is creating, to the degree that Jack does not recognize that he's creating all the diseases and offering the cure, which is the principle of advertising that McLuhan came up with, advertising creates the disease and offers the cure. Okay, so whatever product, oh, you got bad breath or something. In many societies, bad breath is not a problem, but if you got control of the TV landscape, you make bad breath a problem, then you can offer products and make millions solving the bad breath problem, right, for Americans. Okay,
right, certainly
you have
it's
Jack.
Horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, Jack's, it all goes back to Kosovo. Most of the guys who were out to nail Jack and cause problems are pissed off at what happened in 1999 in Kosovo. That's what's historically interesting, which was the first wacky war under Clinton, so to speak, you know, and that led to 9/11 and Afghanistan and all that stuff. So it's actually pretty accurate history of the last 10 years. So it begins in Kosovo, most of the whack jobs that try to take over the world, and Jack has to beat up and then get arrested for stopping them. Remember, Jack's always going to get arrested for stopping the evil people. What was the threat here? In the counterterrorism unit, the Bolsheviks, the five intelligence agencies are represented as I met them and meant them in the Quadrophenic 80s, but By the time George Bush II gets into office, it's a ghetto, the White House. The TV landscape's a ghetto. The intelligence agencies are a ghetto because Y2K proved that there was no more information. And so it's actually not ideological Bolsheviks, Jesuits, or whatever. Jesuits are totally bankrupt now. The Catholic Church is only going to last another couple of years. They have no money, and nobody has any money. So the intelligence agencies don't have any funding. So you just have wacky individuals hijacking the scene, coming out of nowhere. A lot of them are Secret Service guys who just say, I'm fed up protecting George Bush. I'll just become George. I can be George Bush. You don't have to be a smart guy. So they take over, and then they end up getting killed. And the great punchline, I forgot. Let me just hold it here. So in season 6, you find out that the guy creating all these problems that Jack is running around trying to save everybody from is Jack's father.
Ah.
So he's the billionaire guy who's trying to keep expanding his empire, and he controls the presidents and everything, and he gets real perverted. He undermines his own operation because he has an identity crisis too. But the thing is, it then becomes a metaphorical Freudian thing of, you know, Jack is running around trying to solve the world because he's got a problem with his Oedipus complex. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He's rebelling against Dad.
Yeah, and he doesn't know that it's his dad he's rebelling against. And he finds out in season 5 or 6, and I guess it's season 6, and it's a lot of stuff that I've watched. I mean, you got 24 episodes. I've done six 24s. 6 4s or 24 or 2. 144 episodes. I've done 142 episodes. I'm too sure. I've done 144 42-minute things. That's a lot of content. And so Jack finds out that it's his father. And now this whole thing about China taking over, which ION explains the history of all the time on cash flow, they brought this up at the end season 6, the father realizes that there's no point in hanging around America. If he wants his empire to last, he has to go to China. So he hijacks Jack's nephew, his own grandson, to that's where I'm at right now. And the point is, what I was saying is that, you see, people didn't understand why I would give out horrible stories or the background of so-called horrible things like all the assassinations and this and that and the Battle of Harvest Moon, but I'd always be laughing while doing it. People say privately, Bob, you're telling me this horrible stuff. It's depressing, and you're not affected by it. You're laughing at it. I said, yeah, it's a post-information society. As long as people require fake information, I'll give it to them, but I'm not there. I'm not involved in that. It's even more liberating where we're at now. It doesn't matter. And so I find that the level of seriousness that my information seemed to present is the level that 24 is showing. And that's a viable level. And on the level of seriousness, then CTU, or 24, is showing you how it goes on at the world government, solar government level. That's a literal documentary. You've got all the factions, the five factions, right in the same room with you, just like they show them in the CTU. But they don't show them as ideological factions, just different factions, different bureaucratic guys trying to get the next higher job and become head of Homeland Security or something, right? They're all protecting their careers, and they're supposedly protecting the people, but they're only protecting their careers, and they're not even involved in actually solving the problems, which Jack created, and he's the only one who can solve them, and he finds out his father did it all. It's a family affair. And it's exactly what I've said about myself. My father and I, we created our team, created the AIDS virus and killed Kennedy. We did all this. And we created it and had to solve it, you know, and then carry on to the next one. We created the problem and then solved it. And I've always explained exactly why this is the case, using McLuhan, Zappa, LaRouche, William Irwin Thompson, Arthur Croker, Garrett Dean, James Joyce, Finnings, Wake, Cosmic Awareness, Evergreens, and Ion. Always using these great sources to show what's happening. And I'm telling you, you don't even need to listen to me to understand what happened up to the year 2000. Watch 24. It's the perfect course on exactly the way power is.
I just noticed we got 3 minutes left. What I did is I tried to I'm going to attempt that piggyback thing we were talking about.
Yeah, we're going on for another hour.
Right. So what I'm going to do is, like, there's 3 minutes left of this show. When this show ends, I will try to get onto the next show. So there'll be like a lag, like a 5 minute lag probably.
And then I'll phone
so
in.
During that time, if you need to drink some of that Provide stuff. Oh, and that's the other thing. Carolyn switched around her her links, and I can't find the Provide site anymore. I was going to ask you if you could
I'll ask her in the interval because, her site got hacked and it's crashed a bit, and it's broken, so it's being repaired. But I'll ask her in the interval, in the five-minute break.
Cool. So why don't
up. We got another 2 minutes. You talk for 2 minutes about Lost or 24 or what you thought I meant.
Well, I'm starting to realize, like, the thing I like about Jack so much, Jack Shepherd, is that he's an incredible waffler.
Yeah.
And that's what stuck with me the most. And so I'm trying to figure out.
Okay, I got an instant pattern. He is a robot as a surgeon. He's in an institution. He can be 100% super efficient. But in the loss, he's lost when there's no job for him to do. He doesn't really know what the rules are because he's a zombie. He's a robot in the health world. And so that's why he becomes vague and has a total identity crisis and ends up dying.
He's a fish out of water.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The person that seemed most at ease with the whole thing was John Locke.
No, Hurley. Hurley's pretty at ease. But, you know, here's the point.
Pretty at ease, but John never wanted to leave.
Yeah, but he ends up being the smoke monster. See, here's the point. Every psychological attitude or pose that you can take, which is represented by the characters, they all are flawed, guilty people, and they come in and they have the opportunity to figure out what to do without rules, and they can't do it because if they do get half success, it's because their particular personality type is useful in different situations. But overall, it's showing you, like by chart, the different postures of mind one can take in the lost situation. And none of them say it. They all, remember the last show, the second last show, was the reason they all died. They all die. Die in so many levels, several times.
Yeah, they really do.
Which is like the Matrix. Remember, Neo is coming through the sixth time in the one we see. He talks to the architect.
Yeah, he died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, to survive is on the slack of survival. That's you're only going to get that for B, but that requires a lot of fun and work.
Uh huh.
I'm the only guy who survived it all, and then I produced the breakthrough ion, the new technology.
So would you say you're like? So you'd say you're more Jack Bauer than Jack Shepard.
No, I'm better than them. I'm Henry the Fifth on my chart. The Dobbs Squadron has the only successful Shakespearean character, Henry the Fifth. All the rest, McLuhan, LaRouche, Thompson, and Croker, they're Macbeth, King Lear, Othello, and Hamlet. They're all losers.
All right.
But Henry the Fifth is successful.
Well, hey, before they cut us off, let's cut this off. And
okay.
If you want, why don't we try to get back to the original interview on the second hour?
Well, we can do more on Lost. It probably will we'll go towards the interview and then see how that intertwines with what we already said.
Okay, yeah, let's do that. All right.
Okay.
So I will see you in like five.
Okay, great. Bye.